Thank you, Lars. So our workshop, as Lars mentioned, is about CPU connectivity in ion-based systems. And there's a keyword included that's beyond. And so this is the last week of the program. And we, since last week, we, as a group, we have gotten into the mode of reflecting upon what we have learned over the course of these number of weeks, and what's next. And so this talk is very much going to be in that spirit. And when I was preparing for it, I was asking myself, suppose that I allow myself to simplify as much as possible, parts of it may be outrageous, but suppose one does that, is it possible to tie up the CPU connectivity in the ion-based systems with CPU connectivity in a variety of other unconventional, strongly correlated electron systems. So we'll see how that goes. But that's the direction I'm headed. I should also add that in the earlier part of our program, Pierce, where's Pierce? Pierce is not here. Give a very stimulating talk, and in particular, put what we are discussing in this program in a historical context. And I will try to minimize the overlap, but I think the audience probably overlap is somewhat limited. So in any case, I'll start with some introduction anyway. Good. So to talk about unconventional CPU connectivity in these systems, let's put in the context of conventional CPU connectors. And, so this is a BCS CPU connectivity. And this part of history everybody knows. It was the first CPU connector was discovered just over a century ago, and TC was 4K also. And so the study on CPU connectivity over the course of a century is in many ways one of the major driving engines of condensed matter physics research. And if you look at part of this frustration with how TC has grown so slowly over the course of time, it was stuck in the 1970s. Was reached TC reached about 20 something? I think 23 Kelvin was in my mind, something of that order of magnitude, and it was stuck. Again, and so along the line of BCS CPU conductors, the highest TC is in the MGB2. So that's the scale of the transition temperature. And in the middle of all this, BCS came to the understanding and the of what drives these the CPU conductivity. And the only thing which I really want to mention in the context of this talk is that the BCS theory is based on the well-founded understanding of what happens in a normal state. At temperatures above TC, in the sense that we have mercury or other metals, and there's a good basis to say that the elementary excitations are known in such conventional metals. So there's electronic body particles. And so in other words, E squared over R among the electrons, the bare value is never that small, given that R is on the scale of a couple of angstroms. But there's so much screening that's going on because the electrons live in the context of a many electron system, that in the end, the interaction effect becomes very minimized. And an important point is that if you look at the TC, which is on the order of 10 Kelvin, there's a very large separation going from 10 Kelvin all the way to the upper cutoff of the electron physics, which is on the order of a couple of electron volts. So you have many decades of the yes, Sean.
By BCS, you mean phonon mediated, or where the normal state is understood?
I want to say the elementary excitations are improved, electron quasi particles, which I'm mentioning, and phonons, and the coupling between the two give us the understanding of the properties in a normal state, such as resistivity versus temperature. And that provides a basis to have the pairing of the electrons. Okay. So let's see, where was I? So this is the contact of Fermi liquid theory. That we can understand the behavior of a many-body system, which is this number of many electrons. And in the end, we have the elementary excitations, which are electronic quasi particles. And for all the practical purposes, the electronic quasi particles behave just like bare electrons. Okay. And with some renormalization of the parameters, such as effective mass, etc. And then we have phonons, which are the elementary excitations associated with the ions. And so you couple them together, and there's an effective attractive interaction, which in the end arises. And part of what's important is this large separation between the bare electronic energy scale and TC. So TC divided by the effective Fermi temperature is a small parameter that's also an internally consistent procedure, that there's a dynamic screening that reduces the Coulomb repulsion to a value that in a relevant frequency range, these repulsions can be overcome by the attractive interaction induced by the phonons. So this attractive interaction leads to covalent pairs. And associated with the overcoming of the electron-electron repulsion by this dynamical screening process is that you can actually have pairs, the wave function of the pairs has a conventional S-wave symmetry, which is outrageous if you consider the bare electron repulsive interactions. So if you have a conventional S wave symmetry, the wave function, the amplitude of the of these two electrons coming to the same site is non-zero. So according to bare Coulomb repulsion, it's going to be very costly in energy. But because of this dynamical screening, the conventional S wave pairing becomes possible. Okay. So that's all. And as I already mentioned, answering Shankar's question, point that there's a picture for a normal state where you have electronic quasi-particles, and your phonons, which are coupled together, provides a very good understanding of the properties of a normal state. So there's a resistivity versus temperature, already mentioned, but also a variety of other properties, such as magnetic properties, thermodynamic properties, and so on and so forth. Okay. So, so if we want to understand the unconventional superconductivity in the kind of systems we are discussing, we need to understand what is going on in a normal state. So that's very much a part of the central themes of the discussions in this area. All right, so let me list some of the pertinent material systems, unconventional. And I think one could define it in a number of different ways. One way is to say that instead of driven by electron-phonon coupling, unconventional superconductors, superconductivity is driven by electron interaction. In practice, related to that is that the pair wave function that we still have Cooper pairs, but it has a symmetry which is not conventional. And you could have S wave symmetry, but you still can satisfy the condition. Yeah. So I think I sort of covered myself by saying not conventional S wave, but it's more like the only real requirement is that the wave function goes to zero.
Right.
All
things that's not a symmetry.
Yeah. Right.
It's not a conventional wave S wave.
Right. Yeah. So maybe a better way of saying the pairing function, anisotropic in such a way that the amplitude goes to zero when at the small distance. I knew that defining something is going to be not necessarily as precise as I can be. Okay, but the point is that you want to overcome this Coulomb repulsion, and the dynamical screening may not help you with that.
Good.
All right. So I already mentioned that there's ion-based systems, so the caricature of this is that you can just take a square lattice.
Jimmy, it may be hard to see that.
Okay.
For people behind this podium.
Maybe I should. Okay, good, thank you. Is this better? Take the square lattice to have the ions. And so this would be just a layer and you form the material by stacking these layers and some spacers in between, just temporarily bound them together. And let me just mention FPPS. The nucleoid. So you think of the middle of each square bracket having having arsenic plus means that it's above the plane of the square, and the minus means below the plane by equal distance. And standing that. That's sort of the caricature of the iron nictides. There's a variation of that at the SE. And if you come into the any of these talks, you'll be hearing you would hear things like iron nictides, which really refers to materials have FEAS layers or some variation of that. And we will hear words like iron chalcogenides. This is one of the elements in that column.
So nictide means there's arsenic sitting there?
There's arsenic, phosphorus, or elements in that column of the periodic table. And selenium sitting there. And so these materials came to, actually in 2006, when superconductivity conductivity was discovered in the nictides with the phosphorus, with a TC of 6 Kelvin. I think it's fair to say that not too many people paid attention to what happened. 6 Kelvin was no longer special. But 2 years later, TC reached 26 Kelvin, and so that's when the intensive activities on this topic really started, and very quickly this went up to 55 Kelvin, and in the established ion-based superconductors, this is still the record of TC. But over 2 years, 2 years ago, I guess, roughly, in 2002, there was an indication that emerged for superconductivity with a TC of on the order of 65 Kelvin. And I say indication because this was a structure which was not natural, was more was an engineered structure. You take a single layer of ESE and put it on substrate, some oxide substrate. And so there are some measurements you can do, such as measuring the gap. Gap is you have focal pairs, take some energy to break up the pair into individual electronic excitations, and that's the energy cost is the energy gap, and that's the commonly measured in superconductors. And so there's a measurement of the gap of this single layer FESE, and you track that down as a function of temperature and see where it goes away. There's still very limited information about resistivity or diamagnetism in this, just because it's a single layer. It's more difficult. During the course of this program, we also had a discussion of a similar structure, but the indication is that TC is reaching beyond 100, reaching towards 100, over 100 Kelvin. And so I think the status is that this, at least there's no question about experiments, all the papers are published, and the data have been verified by different groups from various parts of the world. The still we call it indication just because there's not much of resistivity and diamagnetism measurements. This is less solid footing for one experiment, but so we had a discussion session, and everybody lot of people went in with a lot of skepticism, but I think it was fair to say that when we finished this discussion, the level of skepticism was reduced. So raises some hope that the TC in this class of materials marching towards even more exciting levels. Now, so this is ion-based superconductivity, and they came not in vacuum. They came in the context of other classes of unconventional superconductivity. Already existed by 2006. So the famous one, of course, is the copper base. And so this was discovered in 1986 with a TC of 230 Kelvin. And TC has been increased, and so 130 Kelvin is the TC and the ambient pressure. And about 160 Kelvin is what happens under pressure. And so that remains the record as far as TC is concerned. And curiously, the cuprates also just you can take a square lattice and replace iron by copper and place the oxygen at a slightly different place of the parquet. And so there's a some degree of similarity in as far as the structure is concerned. And this the cuprate itself was discovered in the background of earlier unconventional superconductors, and I will mention the heavy fermions. So heavy fermions are it's not based on iron or copper, it's based on the cerium, plutonium, which host the F electrons, 4F or 5F electrons. And so this was first discovered in 1975. I think that was the very first unconventional superconductor that was discovered. TC was 0.6 Kelvin. It was not because of TC which caused all the attention paid to it. And a lot of controversy associated with it. It was other physical properties, such as the amount of entropy that was involved is humongous. And that's related to the fact that these are materials which are called heavy fermions. They're extremely heavy. If you interpret the measure properties, such as the specific heat, in terms of the mass of the electronic excitations, the mass is on the order of protons, as opposed to electron mass. And so TC in these materials have been also gradually being raised by the 2,000 years ago. It's eventually over 2 Kelvin, and then eventually it's now it's about 18 Kelvin in this class of materials. And so adding to this could be the organics, and I'll mention to this. So this is the various classes of colloidal electron superconductivity superconductors that are being discussed. And so the question is, this is in heavy fermion systems alone, there's about like 40 or so compounds. So there's a very large number of these unconventional superconductivity, and it could be that each family, each compound just has its unique physics, but it could also be that there's some aspect which may be the key that that could connect to all of these superconductors. So that's the question, so let's march forward. And as I said, I want to look at this in as simplified a way as possible. So let's look at in a very coarse-grained fashion. And we spent a lot of time talking about the phase diagrams of these ion-based superconductors. And even within this category, there are several types of phase diagram vector. So it's temperature and some x, could be doping, chemical doping, or could be pressure. And it typically starts as with antiferromagnetic order, and the antiferromagnetic order is gradually reduced, and a dome of superconductor appears in the phase diagram. And precisely how this the magnetic part of the phase diagram evolves towards the superconducting part, there's some variations even within these ion-based systems. And it's interesting to put them in here. So it all has to do how the magnetic ordering line, the line describing the magnetic ordering phase transition, so crashes towards the superconducting TC line. And so in some cases, they overlap. And in some cases, there's some gap. And there could even be that. So this part is, it's not the most important thing, but we just draw it. So the point is that precisely how you go from the magnetic order to superconductivity, there's a variety of this. Okay. So, so from perspective of draw something that's common, I don't want to pay too much attention on precisely how you go from the antiferromagnetic order to the superconducting ground state. And now, if one stares at the phase diagram like this, and without putting which ion-based system is doing is behaving which way, in fact, one can just morph this phase diagram into those of the other families of toric superconductors. And so for instance, in the heavy fermion superconductivity, the temperature scales are much smaller, but the profiles look very similar. You could have roughly these different ways of going from the antiferromagnetic order to superconductivity. In the copper-based superconductors, the whole doped ones look mostly like this, with some gap in between, and with a lot of physics associated with under the cap, under the rubric of pseudo gap. So there's a, in the ion-based superconductors, this sort of gap region has not been much studied, but in the copper-based systems, that's very much the center of attention at the moment. And in the electron doped cool plates, it looks more like the third one that's shown here. And so that leads to one important element which appears to be happening in all these different classes of foreign superconductors, which is the magnetism. That's one word that appears in the title of our program. That magnetism is very much is something that the superconductivity appears in superconducting phase is in proximity with. But there's something on top of that that's also important and could also be considered as a common feature.
Gino, is there a big difference on the x-axis in terms of where the superconductivity peak occurs, depending on the type of, or is it all just always a small number? When you're doing doping?
You mean in terms of the value of the doping? Yes. Yeah. So it's roughly as far as doping goes, roughly similar, somewhere 15%, 20%. That number is even true for the Cooperians. And that issue may or may not be that universal in the sense that, as I said, you don't have to do doping. You could apply pressure, and that's something for instance, is a very commonly used as a driving axis in heavy thermals, in organics. Good. So I want to say that there's an added element which appears also to be important in this variety of foreign superconductors, and that is that if we know that in the Cooke plates, the anti-ferromagnetic order is actually an insulator, and so in other words, it's a multi-insulator. And this happens in the Cooke plates and in some organics. And just for the purpose of a few of the participants in from the avalanche, or the neutrinos, who may not necessarily deal with the modeling surveys on a daily basis. This is the case where you consider solid breaks the continuous translational symmetry. So there are this is a lattice, and electrons, if the interaction between electrons become very large, if the Coulomb repulsion is larger than the kinetic energy, eventually, the electrons give up on moving around if the fitting is right, because if they move, it runs into the other electrons, and energetically, that's not favorable. So the electrons get stuck, and they behave as spins at low energies. And if you do something to perturb the modeling, so it does introduce doping. You can make it metallic, but it's a very bad metal. Electrons can move, but they move in a very sluggish fashion. And in fact, if you measure the resistivity at room temperature and extract the land scale over which the electrons are able to freely move, that land scale is on the order of the lattice spacing. Okay. So that's one manifestation that the electrons are moving in a very sluggish way. Now, the heavy fermions, the anti-ferromagnetic order state is actually a metal, but a picture like this in fact still applies for the F electrons, which you can know based on measurements at higher temperatures. And the resistivity again and other properties suggest that it's also that metal. The ion-based systems, there's a considerable discussion on whether that's also the case, and but if you look at again similar properties like the magnitude of resistivity from which you extract the mean free path, we can still draw the conclusion that the mean free path is on the order of lattice spacing. Okay, so even though the anti-ferromagnetic order grows out of a metallic state, it's a metallic state in which electrons move in a very inefficient way. And so that can be interpreted that, in fact, we are dealing with, and the statement also applies to some other materials, that we're dealing with the superconductivity, which grows out of a normal state, whose metallicity is pretty bad. And in fact, there's a tendency to interpret the insulating state of the Cooke plate out of which the anti-ferromagnetic order develops as even though it's an inserting, it's actually not that good an inserter. So it's just a bad insert. And that brings up some commonality across these different class of systems. So that leads to the second element, which seems to be very important across these different classes of correlated superconductors. The bad metal, and that's also in the title of our program. And in fact, I want to add one more discussion on these common features, and that's about a particular form of the organic superconductors. So being from rice, the C60s, the buckyballs, have a special meaning. We go to the campus, the buckyballs, and the picture of Rick Smalley sort of everywhere on the campus. And so there's a class of superconductors, the alkali metal superconductor. I think the first one that was discovered was potassium 3 C60, and then there was the rubidium 3 C60. And these were discovered about 25 years ago, and there was a lot of discussion on what was driving superconductivity in these systems. And I think it's fair to say that 20 years ago, the consensus was that these are electron-phonon-driven superconductors. But over the past few years, and this is also something we discussed, Steve in particular had extensive interest on this. And so what made the difference is that now there's one more superconductor in this category of the C60 buckyball family. And this turns out to be a mod inserter with an anti-ferromagnetic order. And so you can pressurize the system, and you can suppress the anti-ferromagnetic order very much with a phase diagram which looks just like this. And then you can put also the potassium and the rubidium C60 superconductors in a phase diagram like this, with X is just the volume of the unit cell. So even this high TC organic superconductors at least judging from phase diagram, is falling into this category of superconductivity that's in the vicinity of anti-ferromagnetic order, and both the superconductivity, superconducting state, and the anti-ferromagnetic order state come out of a bad metal normal state. So both features, the proximity to magnetism and the proximity to the bad metal part of the phase diagram appears to be the things that you can attach as common among all these different kind of coin superconductors. All right, so now the question is, if we say these are the basis, the common elements, how do they connect with superconductivity? How do they come into a description of superconductivity? So the key is, well, there's a sort of a connection between the magnetism and the bad metal, and the connection of this to the superconductivity. Okay. So those are the two central issues in following this, these considerations. And so the part one of this is how do we make the connection between magnetism and bad metal? What's if we want to understand superconductivity, given the proximity, we want to understand the nature of magnetism. And so is there a very simple way to think about the magnetism? Quote unquote simple way. And also a way that it can connect these cuprates, heavy fermions, and ion-based systems, as well as the organics. Okay. So again, I'm looking at this in a very coarse grain way. So I think I described to Peter, one of my fellow co-organizers. I said, "Oh, you know, I'm going to start from 30,000 feet in the air. I'm going to descend to 3,000 feet, and then come to the ground." And his advice at that point was that you get the parachutes ready.
Okay.
All right. So, the one way to tie together the consideration of the magnetism is that we can actually just write down the magnetic part as spins interacting with each other, and then add various terms which describe the metallic nature of the system, which either when you suppress the antiferromagnetic and the inserting state, or inherently you're already starting from a bad metal state.
Okay.
And good. So the point is that this is something that we do on. Everybody does it for the footprints. For heavy fermions, it's less obvious in the sense that it's metallic. But as I said, at the, we know that there's a very firm basis to know that the local moments, the F electrons, are so strongly interacting with each other that in the end they behave as local moments. And in the heavy fermion case, it's just that there's another band of conduction electrons which are coupled to these local moments, and that is metallic. In the ion-based systems, it's actually a debate as to whether one can write down a spin Hamiltonian like this. And to me, it's the simplest way, and it would be at least if I take into consideration of the fact that it's a bad metal, the spin parts can be constructed in this way. And if you proceed from this with some different, I raised this structure, you have the ions on square lattice, and you have these arsenics or seleniums that are equal distance from the ion sites. So it turns out that the J's would at least involve J1 and J2. The J1 is the nearest neighbor interaction, and J2 is the next nearest neighbor interaction across the diagonals. And this, with some additions that are allowed on general grounds, would in fact allow you to understand the magnetic order and all that. But so there's some basis of using this to describe the nature of magnetism, and we have continued discussion on this. I think tomorrow we'll have a talk about local moment physics in these ion-based systems. So the point is that if one, again, look at the coarse grain, take a coarse grain perspective on these systems, you have the J's, which describe the interactions between these spins, and that provides the basis to understand magnetism. But these exchange interactions can also provide a way to give rise to unconventional superconductivity. And so this kind of thinking actually is there's an internal consistency to it. Namely, if this is the basis for magnetism, well, we can check whether the description it provides a reasonable description of the magnetic order and the magnetic dynamics. But if this is the basis for also for as a driving force for superconductivity, one can ask the question whether that's something that's internally consistent and or particularly is testable. And so the procedure that has been used to do this internal consistency check is to determine two energies. So one is the exchange. This actually is a procedure that was pioneered by Doug and Tony Leggett and others in the context of cube plates, and it has been kind of widely used in other systems as well. So we can ask question. Let's call this S H of J, and one can determine this energy, internal energy associated with this term for the normal state, and we can determine the internal energy associated with this term in a superconducting state, and ask question how much energy saving, or is there energy saving, and if so, whether it's adequate in some sense. Okay? So we can define delta of Ej, which is defined as the exchange energy for normal states minus the exchange energy for the superconducting state. Okay? And in practice, so internal energy has taken the expectation value of this Si dot Sj. And that expectation value can be determined through the measurements of the spin spectrum over the wide range of Q and over wide range of energy. Okay? And you can do that for the normal state, and you can do that for the superconducting state. Okay? If the say by inelastic neutron scattering, and then you can compare that. Maybe I should move on to compare to the superconducting condensation energy, and which is defined as condensation. It's, I'll just use different notation just to differentiate between. So this would be just the internal energy at t equal to zero of the normal of the putative normal state and the internal energy of the entire system. This is the exchange part, and that's the overall internal energy. Okay. And this quantity, it's neither is very easy to determine because the superconducting part of the phase diagram, the superconducting state is a ground state, and this normal state refers to the putative normal state. But in the case of, in some cases, for instance, in the heavy fermion superconductors, this actually can be at least more easily determined. Most of these quantities can be more easily determined compared to the other cases because, as I said, the energy scales are smaller, so you can apply some small amount of magnetic field to suppress the superconductivity and get the normal counter.
Sorry, Chim Yao.
Yeah.
What do these guys want to do with these numbers? I don't get it.
I'm coming. So first, determine. So the question I'm asking is, suppose this is the driving force for superconductivity. Is that a checkable statement?
I'm not even sure what that statement means. I mean, there are no electrons in your Hamiltonian.
Well, it's a metal, right? So this thing ultimately will be expressed in terms of electrons in some way.
Okay.
Precisely how you do that is different in different cases. So in the heavy fermions, for instance, you have to invoke the coupling of, these are actually well-defined local moments, and you have to invoke the Condon coupling with the spins of the conduction electrons to convert them into something that can participate in superconductivity. But if I leave, nonetheless, if I write down this term as part of the Hamiltonian, I can ask how much it contributes to the internal energy. And I can ask the same question both for the superconducting ground state and the putative normal ground state.
Now, if that number was positive, what do you learn from that?
So I learned that this term, this is a potential term that's contributing to the saving of the energy as I go from normal to the superconducting state. And I need the savings, you know, because I know that the CP conductivity is a ground state because there's a condensation energy, right? Because this quantity is positive. Right? And I can ask how much of the contribution that I estimate from there is compared with that. Okay. So there's issue of how accurate you should measure, but for heavy fermions, at least you can get this very accurately. And then we had a talk from Stefan Kirshner, which reached the conclusion that the exchange energy saving, there is indeed exchange energy saving, and the magnitude is large, is larger than the condensation energy. And in fact, it's considerably larger. The ratio of the two is on the order of 20. So that's an internal consistency to say that the interactions which are responsible for magnetism is in fact at least contributing in a major way to the development of cyclic conductivity. Again, this is a very coarse-grained view. That's as much as one can say. Precisely how the magnetic interactions drive cyclic conductivity, there are a variety of different ways of thinking about it. Okay. All right.
Yeah, also in the thermal case, you were mentioning the quantum coupling. I mean, isn't that part of the important part of the story?
Yeah, so in fact, the quantum coupling in this logic could actually be considered as the kinetic energy, in the sense that the quantum coupling is actually is responsible for getting the itinerancy that out of the local moment. So the factor of 20, you know, would also mean that there's a very large loss of the kinetic energy. And one could actually think of general reasons that that the quantum effect is part of what's responsible for getting lost in kinetic energy.
But when I'm coupled with this exchange energy saving, one kind of assumes an insulating spin on the
hydrogen,
is that practically what's
done? So the energetics that assumption doesn't come into the analysis. All that to say is that you can measure this correlation function, right? The spin-spin correlation function, and you have some way of estimating what the J is now, and that's all that's involved. So it could be considered as an advantage that I'm not putting in a bias of how to think about what happens with spin into the analysis. But it does allow one to reach the conclusion that the interactions in the magnetic sector are involved in a major way in driving spin. All right, so with that, connects the magnetism with cyclic conductivity, but one could still look at these issues in a somewhat more refined way. And so that leads me to the issue of how do we place these different classes of correlated superconductors in a slightly more microscopic axis. And so in other words, I said that there's that what seems to be common among all these different systems is that they are bad metal. So how do we think about the bad metal aspect, and how do we connect that with the magnetism? And I already mentioned that if you have a mod insulator, it means that the interaction divided by the kinetic energy is very large. So if you have a commercial affiliate, this is where there's localization. So these electrons want to move around, but they don't get very far. So the electronic excitation spectrum is very coherent and sitting at high energies. And it's integrating out these high energy excitations of electrons that give rise to the J, the exchange interaction between the local moments. But on this axis, at the end of the day, magnetism is a part of the, it's called electron physics. So one can draw axis like this. And so if this is non-interacting limit, this is a very strongly interacting limit, then the systems are very itinerant on one end, and on the other end, it's very localized. And we expect that there's a transition between the two, at least one transition. Okay? And so this is some threshold value for the dimensionless interaction. And this is where the system is sitting at a boundary between the itinerancy and the localization. Now, there are two points which can be made in if we put the discussion so far in this context. One is that if one calculates J from as a function of this parameter that defines the axis, one reaches the conclusion that so if this is an interaction, can you see? It's been blocked. J divided by kinetic energy. And so at the very large interactions will be T squared over U, so it will be increasing. And at the boundary is where this J is maximized. And so it's continuous. And eventually, the incoherent part of the electron spectral wave is sucked into the condensed state. And so it's maximized. So to the extent that the exchanging interaction is driving superconductivity, one a plot like this would suggest that indeed in the vicinity at the boundary, in the vicinity of this sort of crossover, this boundary between localization and itinerancy is where you have energetically most favorable in getting superconductivity. And that perhaps is one way to rationalize why bad metal is a common denominator among these different classes of unconventional superconductors. Now, so that's one part of it. And the second point related to that is that if we have exchange interactions in these things, it does a lot of things besides being acting as a driving force for superconductivity. So, J, the most natural tendency of J is to promote the magnetic order. Among other possible orders. So in order to give superconductivity a chance, one would like to basically tune the system such that the solid behavior for the electrons, electron spins, needs to be suppressed. So you want to melt the anti-ferromagnetic order in the context we're discussing. And so that suggests that one would like to go to the boundary or the border of the magnetism. In order to give superconductivity a chance, it is the same term in the Hamiltonian. You suppress its natural tendency to establish order. And so in other words, one could think of two elements for which the magnetism and the bad metal physics come into play in a description for superconductivity. And the, both of them has to do with the border or boundary. One is at the border and boundary of itinerancy and localization, and the other is at the border of madness. And this line of consideration would implies that would imply that both elements are important. Okay. And again, there's are we almost? Oh, okay. I didn't realize that. So I guess maybe just
we were almost there.
Maybe just 2 minutes sort of are getting to the complete line. So I want to say that both considerations provide actually there's some basis for that. So if you only have one of them, for instance, if you're not at the boundary, if it's a fully itinerant system. And a system like chromium, which is also anti-ferromagnetic order, and it's very itinerant. If you suppress its anti-ferromagnetism, one doesn't get much out of it. So there's no strange metal physics, like resistivity, versus tension, and behaving in an unusual way. And so far, there's no superconductivity that has been observed. But in the cool plates and heavy fermions, organics, and the ion-based systems, they one can at least consider them at the boundary between itinerancy and localization, and you suppress anti-ferromagnetic order, and that's where you have both the strange metal physics in resistivity and thermodynamics and other properties, and superconductivity. Okay? So. So that provides the consistency, another basis to say that both elements are important. So let me close in 15 seconds to say that these considerations point, at least if following this line of thinking, it points to some questions, theoretical questions, which are important, which may be important and profitable to study. Which is that we want to study the quantum critical points associated with both the localization and delocalization. And also of magnetism. And it turns out that in some cases, such as the heavy fermion superconductors like cerium, rhodium, indium 5, there's considerable evidence that these two types of quantum critical behavior actually come together, or at least are very close by. And it perhaps is not an accident that in that case, it's really high TC in the sense that TC divided by the Fermi temperature is on the order of 10%, unlike 10 to minus 3 or 10 to minus 4 for BCS superconductor. So let me just end by saying that this is one example of bringing these different classes of correlated superconductors together and having the crosstalk among the various issues in these different categories of materials. That's a very potentially very fruitful, and that's the spirit that this workshop has been run. We've had a lot of fun with it, and the hope is that it will have some impact for the developments that follow. Thank you.
I actually have two questions to start with. Is there any evidence for? So is there any evidence for superconductivity in two-dimensional systems?
The FESE example that I give you, built on the substrate, it's really a single layer.
Oh, so and there is evidence.
So that's as strong evidence as it gets.
Is it easier to work with the theory of two-dimensional systems?
Yes.
I would think so. Okay. My other question, is there any evidence that nature uses superconductivity naturally, evolution or cosmology or astrophysics?
We didn't have a chance to discuss that in our workshop, but we've had, I think KIPP has had other workshops. So the short answer probably is yes, but I'm not sure we'll get into that in this particular talk.
I think some people talk about color superconductivity, don't they? Superconductivity in the color channel.
Absolutely, yeah, in QCD and other contexts. So.
One question. He's holding back for wine and cheese. All right, next.
Sure, thank you.